there, shipping maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front end web design development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, Chris. Absolutely. Just Dave and I this week. We thought we'd do a rapid fire show or answer as many questions as we can anyway. Let's just get into it. We have Rachel Ann here asking a kind of a classic question that we've had a number of times over the year and is a hot topic in the industry, which is, how do I know if I'm ready to be a senior or lead developer? Rachel says, I get recruited for these positions all the time, but my imposter syndrome gets the best of me. I've turned down two different senior role offers because I'm just not sure if I'll live up to their expectations. I love web development. I feel like I understand the entire life cycle of making websites. I freelance in my spare time. I've been programming professionally for about 3 years total. So I don't know. Is she ready? And she asked us, you know, when did we know we were ready to be a senior developer? Did it just happen, sink or swim?
Good question. Am I a senior? I guess technically.
We both work at such developer. Small little companies that we just never get the title, really. You know.
Here's what I was going to say. Take it, Rachel. Take the money and effing run. Just cash. Get the money while you can. I think it's just, this may be silly, but like, these are so poorly defined. Like, I think.
Oh, for sure.
I think you should just get the title and move up from there. Like,
hell yeah.
This is capitalism, Dave, talking. So, you know, but I definitely agree with you. I'm.
Do you want it, Rachel? Yeah. Then take it.
Yeah. But there is this like it's so poorly defined, and we tried to define it on the show a few times. I mean, like we had a panel of like, what is a senior developer, right?
Yeah,
like,
and I love that. You know, there's things I think of that I still really like a senior developer is a force multiplier. Absolutely love that one. It means that it's not your skill necessarily, it's your team playerness and you're lifting up everybody around you. I know you're partial to the rising tide lifts all boats kind of concept. That is factors in with people too. If you're the one standing in a room that's making everybody better because you're there, that's a senior developer. In this case, that doesn't matter. I mean, it does. That'll make you a good senior developer, but you're just trying to like get the job at all. And if you got people offering you the job and you're asking your listener of Shop Talk Show and you know, people are trying to get you for this and you want it because you're into it. Clearly, if you're freelancing and it's your job and you're living this stuff, then live it, do it, take it. End of story.
Yeah, I think this is yours, Rachel. Rachel Ann, maybe if you, I don't know if your last name is Ann. Anyway, I think that force multiplier is a really good thing. Do people come to you with questions? You know, I think is a good, you know, like kind of personal metric, you know, like if you're in a team of 10 people or do people say like, Rachel, how do I do this? Like, or like, what's the best way to embed an SVG icon or something like that? And you're just like, oh yeah, I know this one. Like, you know, I think that's like, you know, I think that's where, at least in this like situation where it's very loosely defined, I think like that can be, you know, that can work out for you. If you work in an organization where it's very strictly defined, you know, you may have to climb the ladder quite a bit. You know, you have to maybe be an engineer one and engineer two and then a senior engineer. But like, if it's not if it's not strictly defined, like just take the title, like get it. So I hate to be that, I don't know. I hate to be that ruthless, but man, I think at 3 years, if you've been doing this job, like people are probably like starting to ask you questions and stuff like that. You know, I think it makes a big deal. And you could probably do that. So.
Heck yeah. Igor Benek writes in, he's working on a WordPress plugin for handling sponsorships of podcasts, or at least sponsorships here. I think it's specifically podcasts, so pretty niche thing, but cool. Wrote in and said, do you have he was kind of doing data research on us, which is fine, but we'll just do it on the show instead. Do you have any struggles when handling sponsors? Do you have a process from, you know, between the sponsorship request and the purchase and moving them onto the site from there? So I thought it would be an opportunity for us to just explain how we do it in a way. We have a page on the site that just says, hey, we have We have, it's like slash Stop Talk Show slash advertising or slash sponsorship or something. Sorry, there's a link in the sidebar to it, I'm sure. And we just charge a price for them, you know, and you can buy them, and you don't buy them through us. You buy them through a company called Syndicate Ads, which is like a child company of a company called Buy Sell Ads. Now, that's the self-service way of doing it, meaning you can just look at a calendar, pick it off a date and buy it. And we work with them because, hey, they offer that service and that's cool. But what makes them particularly valuable to me is that they then take over the wrangling of the advertising, meaning that they communicate with the person who bought it, get all the content together, and then let us know when that content is ready to go. And we use it and produce the ad and put it on the site. So that's great because that's a lot of emailing and just back and forthy stuff that I'm not that interested in doing. Although, I mean, not, it's funny because we work with direct sponsorships too, because it's probably the way we sell half our ads. It's not direct through a calendar like that, but through a package deal that we hand put together for sponsors. And sometimes podcasts are a part of that. And in that case, I am happy to communicate and make sure that that messaging is perfect for the whole package together, you know, that kind of thing. So it's work. I mean, if Igor's asking like, what kind of like technological solution could be useful here? There may be things that ease the process here and there, but I'd say mostly it's like, it's just work and you got to do it. It's email.
Yeah, it's email. It's a lot of, you know, there's, you know, people can book shows or whatever, like, oh, I want the, you know, these four shows or August or something like that. And, you know, we can do that, but you know, there is some risk involved on our part. Like there's a chance we miss a show, you know, somebody breaks two arms or somebody has a kid or, you know, like
this stuff happens.
It's so like, so there's,
you know, what's funny though, you know, all these years I've never done it. We've never had to just me or just you do the show ever.
I think once you had to do it. Cause I like might've had a kid or something, but I think there's just one show, but. Or two, if you count the guy who hacked your
website. It could happen, though, and I don't even mind if it does. If it happened next week, so what? It happened, you know?
Right, right. But it's, you know, in the like grand history, like, you know, we schedule and then we try to get sponsors into those shows. And, you know, our podcast editor, Chris Enns, he helps out a lot, like kind of managing that and
yeah, it's funny. There is a little bit more to the process, right? Like once they're sold and scheduled and it's clear what the advertiser wants, you know, because sometimes they say, here's a script. You read the script. Sometimes they want you to just totally spitball it. Fine. And then sometimes it's talking points is probably the most common. Like here's some stuff that's important to us right now and riff off those. Great. I don't care. Honestly, of all three of them, I don't mind. I have no preference between any of them.
And some want like you to send an MP3 to them to review to like QA the like
that's true
spot read and that's okay. Like it just adds, it's tough when it's on a tight deadline, you know? So
it is, you know, worst time I've ever, I think I had to do one four times once and I was by the fourth time, you're just like, okay, you know, like, is it you or me or what? And, but then, you know, I remember it distinctly, and I think I smiled my way through the fourth one because I'm like, you know what? This is the job. This is what I sell. I sell advertiser being happy with their spot, and if they're not happy, that's me failing. So I just damn did it. Anyway, so there's also, just not a lot of tech. Like, there just isn't. What's that?
Well, and I was going to say, we try to, I don't know, we try to like make sure the company kind of fits our, you know, ethos of the show, provides value to the listener, provides value to,
right,
you know, we don't have maybe like 100% approval or like thumbs up, thumbs down. But I can remember situations where we've had to like kind of be like, yeah, we're not going to do this company.
Yep.
So like, so we've tried to keep it in the wheelhouse.
We have first right of refusal for sure.
So, you know, that's stuff too. You got, if you're designing software for it specifically for Igor's case, like you got to kind of, you know, just because somebody clicked
a
I can't even remember, but it was Squarespace.com. Have you ever heard? No.
No, I don't mind Squarespace, but we, whatever. That's a complicated story.
Yeah.
Like if it was political in nature, I'd probably say no. Just why go there, you know?
Yeah, out of the wheelhouse, right? Of like, of what we're trying to do, or yeah. If it was, golly, I don't even know what would, you know, yeah, like political in nature would probably be like a probably not, you know, stuff like that.
Just to any kind of known company looks like it sucks, you know, and there's, it's surprising. It's not always big names. Sometimes you just, it's something you haven't even heard of and they like, you know, sell janky fonts or something. And you look at their homepage and you're like, that doesn't look right.
Yeah.
You're like, nah.
Fonts and workout supplements. And you're like, wait a minute.
You know, there is some technology. Yeah, we should do it. But real quick, there's that, you know, like the concept of that you don't, like on our show, you just, your ad will be integrated onto the MP3 forever. Have you seen the like technology where it like injects them dynamically upon the server request of what gets played?
Yeah, that's wild too. Like, so they can like buy out almost like an ad impression, right? Like a, yeah. No, I think that's probably the future of podcasting. If I'm going to say that's probably the future, like, I think that's kind of what Stitcher does, right? Like Stitcher will be like, hey, you want to be on our network, but we're also going to run an ad in between your podcast and your friend's podcast.
You know what? One of the reasons it's the future is nobody cares about the perpetuity thing. I feel like that should be so valuable. You know, when you're offering an ad that gets permanently embedded into content forever, you'd think like, God, that's something. That's a permanent link. That's got to be worth 10x, I would think. And I just don't feel advertisers thinking that way. They're just like, oh, I just want some clicks. I just want to buy some impressions or whatever. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you'd think it would have value too. I have so many podcasting advertising feels like to this day, I pay for products I heard on dig.com, Netflix. GoDaddy.
Yeah. Oh, it works.
These are things I heard, and I still am a member of these things 12, 15 years later. You know, it's like to tell me like podcasts are not like, or like, I feel like they should be 10x the value of like normal advertising. And I would love that for everybody.
Hey, let's play an ad right now.
This episode is brought to you by Backlog. Backlog is the perfect task management software for any team. If you're not familiar with Backlog, I'll give you the URL right up front so you can check them out. Backlog.com/shoptalk. Developers and tech companies know the importance of organization and efficiency when it comes to collaborating on a team. So what makes Backlog the perfect project management software for your team? With Backlog, you can create tasks, track bugs, make changes, give feedback, and have team conversations right next to your code. It integrates with tools you use every day like Slack, Jira, and Google Sheets. Take your work on the go using top-rated mobile apps available on Android and iOS. Do all this and more with one easy-to-use tool. Create great products from start to finish with Backlog. You can try it for free for 30 days at backlog.com/shoptalk. That's backlog.com/shoptalk. Our thanks to Backlog for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Why not?
Yeah, you fell for it. You walked right into that one asking that question. So, hey. All right. Tyler Williams writes in, I work on a team of designers who usually hand us designs built at 1920 by 1080. Our product owners are reasonably want everything to be responsive. I can make 1920 breakpoint pretty spot on, and I have a good grasp of basic document design and styling, and I can choose a smaller viewport, say 320, and shrink it down to one column. But in the in-between has inconsistencies, and I get reasonable constructive feedback that the comps don't match the implementation on things like medium DPI screens. How do you go from single design comp down to responsive implementation?
That's an interesting situation. I think there's like not enough detail about who you're working with and what the workflow is to get there. So you're saying you have these giant comps. 1920 is huge for a web. Like, is there a column down the middle there? Or are they designing like the super duper widescreen? You know, like my widescreen's wider than that, but you know, like 1920. My God, that's like way too long for a column of text. It's a big screen, yeah. And then immediately the next thing you make is a three, like you're just handed that and then you make a 320 out of it with no comp at all. Like that's, you're making some choices there, bro. You know?
Right. Right. I mean, this is where like, I would probably call yourself a designer. I mean, cause
Hell yeah.
You're responsible for, well, I'm doing some quick math, 1600 pixels of riffing. So like, like that's a lot of riffing. That's a lot of design that happens in those 1600 pixels. And you're definitely right. Like the middle breakpoints, like the tablet or even just large old phone, like the 550 pixels wide, that's where it gets so weird. And it's so ugly and it's so bad. So I don't know. There's a few things I would maybe say is one, I think it might help if your designers let go of pixel perfection, and that's easier said than done. Cause a lot of this is kind of just playing the averages and trying to make it as good as possible, but also ensure flexibility. So it does scale up, you know, the 1600 pixels of scaling. And then the second thing is like, I would start mobile first and work up to the big, like I wouldn't, you know, I mean, you're maybe doing that already, but just make sure your code is shrinking or growing up and not shrinking down, only because I think like you can get a lot. It's a lot easier to code a website than to grow a website than to shrink it down into one column. And then the third thing I'd maybe suggest, and this is just, I'm kind of blanking on it, but I would just like, I would try to figure out a way to work with your designers more in real time, like sharing production builds and be like, here's this, pull it up on a phone or a tablet and give me some feedback, like what, or take screenshots. I do this a lot, take screenshots and post them in Slack and be like, hey, this is looking weird at, you know, 728 pixels, you know, like I could use some direction, you know, like be very collaborative with your design team if possible. So, and even maybe don't solve one layout, try to solve multiple layouts. Like, hey, this, you know, sidebar view doesn't quite work. So how would the sidebar view work at 600 pixels or something? So,
yeah, I'm still just very caught up on the idea that somebody tossed you a 1920 comp and expects you to just invent exactly every breakpoint in between that. It's like, really? Not even a small comp? Nothing? Like, that's cool if they just, that's a lot of trust. So if anybody has any problem with the choices you made along the way, then they need to get more involved.
Yeah.
Like, that's not designed to design one thing and just be like, every, you know, read my mind, every size permutation of this should be whatever I would do if I had time, but I don't. Or come on.
No, in the year 2019 here, assuming this episode goes out on time, we got to be thinking mobile first. Like the 1920 comp is dated. So like, don't even maybe demand a mobile comp first and then to say like, I'll max width this at like 600 pixels and you tell me what to do. So after that, I don't know. I think you got to be concerned about that too. In the year 2019, we got to be a lot more mobile. So yeah.
Yeah. We were just talking about podcasting. We can probably talk about it a little bit more, because Frederick Weiss wrote in, it was a little bit while back now, but Frederick is on the podcast Thunder Nerds, one of the creators of that. Been on that show. And Frederick says, I believe that I run a podcast that provides value to the community, yet I'm not getting the visibility that I'm looking for. How do I grow my audience in an efficient yet valuable way? There's like Google Ads and other places that I could advertise yet, but I'm not sure if those flavors of display ads are right for me and authentic enough for our message. How can I get Thunder Nerds out there? So, yeah, that's a tricky game. I definitely wouldn't. If your end game is to sell ads, that like, you know, that's a losing battle to buy ads to get audience to sell ads to. Like, you're not going to win that game. The casino, you know, the house has got your favor there. Do you have like some numbers in mind? Do you just like want it to be a bigger show? Like, the goals seem a little bit vague to me, because all you said here is that, you know, I'm just not getting the visibility I'm looking for. And it's not for lack of trying. I can obviously tell. I go to the website now, 227 episodes. Holy cow. You're doing great that wise. So it's not like through lack of effort, you know, the website is fine. You're on all the platforms. it doesn't seem like you're doing anything technological or content wrong too, because, you know, it's a lot like other podcasts, it looks like ours too, that has some big names of tech people in it. So you're even leveraging their audience too. So I am kind of curious what's happening there, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think I have a blog post kind of in my drafts folder about like what I think makes a successful podcast. And I think there's two core components, and one is consistency. And sometimes to a fault, I think having a weekly schedule is like maybe more important than having really, really good content, if that makes sense. Like being delivered every week and showing up in people's podcatchers is like probably the most, like on a consistent cadence.
That's funny you put so much value in that. Could you go into that more? Like, why do you think that's such a big deal?
You know, if I only check in once a week, or let's say the average listener has 5 drives to work and home from work or something. Mm-hmm. A podcast like Shop Talk is an hour long. So that's like a drive there and a drive home or something, let's say, right? You know, so they're going to listen to 5 podcasts a week. Let's say we don't show up on week 2, right? And then we're like, oh, but then week 3, we come out with 2 episodes or something, like or we batched them weird or whatever. You know, it's not like a routine. It's not like there's Shop Talk every Tuesday. I listen to Shop Talk on the way to work or something like that. Like everybody's different, but I'm just kind of like the baseline for me is like, you got to show up consistent, so that you're like a familiar face. You're reminded, you have to be digestible or good enough content. You like, make sure you're not going too long, make sure you're honoring people's time. I think that's like very important. And then number 2, I think honestly, a lot of the podcasts, like if you look at large, like a lot of successful podcasts are based on a previous success, if that makes sense. And like Shop Talk probably rides the coattails of CSS Tricks a bit, you know, just like CSS Tricks was a success and we're kind of riding that. Syntax FM, that's because Wes and Scott have killer courses, you know, like you look at This or Gimlet Media, all of those is because they worked with This American Life before that, you know, like, which was an NPR show, you know, and back when you could only listen to one NPR station at a time. So
yeah, all these comedy podcasts for people that are just funny anyway. So they get a show and right. They do that. I think that's almost always the case. Almost always, you know, and maybe that's the issue. You know, if I poke around at your site, Fred, I hope this isn't too personal, but it's like, it kind of, you know, your personal website is actually very nice and seems fine, but it's like, my thing is, you know, I have some job or whatever, but I do this podcast, you know, like maybe can you throw a blog on that podcast or on that personal site and like do that too. So the podcasting isn't just like the whole pie. It's not like everything you do. You're known for your writing or you have videos of you speaking or something that's like, it's not just that thing, especially for a niche show like web tech like this. Like this is the smallest thing I would think Dave and I do. And I don't think we're that. And here's another trick. You could just stop caring if you're successful or not. I mean, I don't think we're certainly not betting the farm on this podcast. It's like a nice fun thing that we do, but I do it because I like talking to Dave, you know, like in the beer money doesn't hurt,
you,
but it,
buddy.
Yeah, you know, but you know what I mean? Like we're not,
yeah.
Depends on what your goals are. And we keep our goals low.
You know, I do another podcast with my friend Jan and Zach. It's about video games. And like, I thought, oh, it's called The Side Quest and you can find it. But it's a video game podcast. And it was like, okay, cool. I think this will be a total success. It's like 300 downloads, like, you know, kind of, I think that's like average-ish, you know, I don't know, but it probably even less, like it's only like 32 today and we launched an episode, you know what I mean? And so like, or maybe 71 per episode or something. No, it's like 100 downloads. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the updated set. It's like 100 downloads a week or something like that. And like, that's not a lot, but it's like, that's not why we're doing it. And so like, would I love more people to listen to it? Absolutely. Could I hustle some more and broadcast that? Probably a bit more, but like, you know, but it's sort of this thing. It's like, how, you know, what are you wanting to get out of it? What are your goals and what would be the results? And, you're looking for. And I think for us, like,
here's another one. I like that too, but can you, you know, even when we started this one, looking around, we're like, there's an awful lot of just interview, just like, well, you want to know the story behind the person kind of thing. And you're like,
when did you first figure out you were creative? You know,
so. Every podcast is that. And you know why? Because it's interesting. It's good. Like, the interview format is the reason it's ubiquitous is because it's kind of a good format. You get a good guest on, it can be an amazing show, but it's everybody's doing it. Absolutely everybody. So it's not a way to differentiate yourself. And the people that you get, you know, you, I don't know, like, don't ask me on your show for this is general advice for the rest. Like, I've told my same exact story a million times. In fact, now when I get an email about interviewing me, I almost always say yes, because it's flattering and it's fun and maybe mine as well. But I'll almost always put something in the reply email that's like, listen, I've told my middle-class white boy growing up privileged in America story a million times. There's nothing interesting in there. Like, maybe it's interesting to other people more than me because I've told it a bunch of times, but like, I'm telling you, I can tell you about how I went to college for ceramics. It'll be interesting for 30 seconds, but it's not the bedrock from which a great podcast is built.
Yeah, yeah.
What is break a story. You know what a good story is? Break a story. Like, find some interesting tech nugget, even if it's a story somebody else has already told. Now, I see this happen on big podcasts all the time. Somebody will publish a great book or something, and they'll do a podcast that's just like, the story is just kyped from the book. You're like, rude, yeah. But it's such a good story that they did it anyway, because it might be how people are done for it. But you know what I mean? Like, do a little journalism, find a juicy story. People will, I mean, that's what gets shared around, you know?
No, I mean, there's a lot of, like, you know, I think you could even go in and just like, what are people talking about? We want to talk about what people are talking about right now or something. And, you know, Chris and Dave don't do a good job or something like that. Or, you know, find your angle or what is the, you know, like,
no, there's a
you know,
good
what is your spin that you can put on it? Or what is the, you know, there's recently the Ladybug developer podcast, which is for women doing a podcast. Like, that's awesome. I love that because it is, you know, it's a different voice than what the average voice is in podcast land. And that's for women developers coming around talking about things. And I think that's like, that's great. And like, we need more of that. But I also think, like, you know, I think it's okay to just kind of, what's your spin? What's the flavor? And just, you know, establish that formula, you know, like maybe you add something different. You know, I mean, we started this podcast, we had a soundboard, you know, not a lot of development podcasts had a soundboard when we started, you know, like it's.
This is a good hard-boiled egg.
It's dumb, and gimmicky, but like straight up, that's like something people remember, you know. And a lot of people did not like our gunshot sounds, and that's why we don't do those anymore.
Along that side, edit it. You know, we've never done that. We're kind of, we have an editor, Chris does a great job, but I mean, edit it. You know, we've never tried that. One time we tried to do it, and we ended up failing and scrapped the damn thing. But it was like, get clips and edit them together. You know, like, have a post process in which that you're bringing to life the story that you're trying to present, which is different than like we do, which is we hit record, we hit stop. Chris does the levels and puts the ads in and smooths some stuff out, but it's not like, it's not editing in that sense of like, you're a director of this podcast and you are telling, I mean, obviously it's a lot more work, but that's what makes a beautiful podcast. I've always been, it's been on my mind for years, Dave. Like,
sometimes I'm like, hey, like, you read a blog post that's really good or whatever. And sometimes I'm like, oh man, could we like, pay the person who wrote it to read it. Like, could we
Hey,
for $10 and then we're going to put it on our podcast and then we're going to kind of stitch it together in a theme, sort of like a This American Life, but it's sort of like this.
Boom. Then you have segments, you know, how fascinating. Segments, that's a great idea.
And then you hop on there and you go, hi, welcome to the show.
Yeah.
Today we're talking about websites, how they impact us, how they move us, how they change the world. Our story in 3X, you know, like you just like like make a formula, you know, and then you have three people just read their blog posts, like, or maybe it's an edited version or just part of it or something like that. And, or maybe they read it. And then maybe act two is you kind of interview them about it, you know, like set it up and have a musical break and stuff like that. We don't have musical breaks. Maybe we do right now, Chris. All right, we're back.
You know what the JS party did the other, they do interesting formats sometimes that I think is pretty cool. Episode 87, they did websites should work without JavaScript. Yep. Nope. Which is great. I listened to it on my way to work and they split into two with a moderator and then had to debate club each other. And two people Ooh. Were assigned that Java websites should, you know, should work without JavaScript. And two said, oh, that's silly that, you know, JavaScript can be a requirement. And it was fun because they, you know, it wasn't necessarily their personal opinion. They were assigned to advocate for that position.
I love it. I'm going to download that right now in my podcast.
It was fun, and it gets better as it goes on because in the beginning they have to like make very broad opening statements, and I think broad statements is too hard when you're talking about the entire internet. Mm-hmm. Later on it gets more nuanced and what would you do in X, Y, and Z situation. And it's inspired me. I have an article I'm working on about it because, you know, so that, look at how great of a, just that interesting format really like was a good listen, you know, interesting voices, you know, it's got me writing a blog post about it. You know, it's a little bit better than, you know, hey, where'd you go to college? You know, when'd you know you wanted to be an actor?
Well, and I think there's also something too, like you want to be active in communities. You know, I feel like you could just hop on our web dev and just be a familiar face answering questions or, you know, or Stack Overflow or whatever. Like, I hate the term build an audience, but that's basically what it is. But like just go and do things, you know, like be a familiar face. You know, I think Twitch is probably the next frontier here. We were talking about it before the show. I'd love to start a Twitch. I just have to get my clients to buy it. But like, you know, like wouldn't it be cool? Just like, I don't know. Just like there, you have to make sure you have like you're contributing, you know, as well. Like you're putting out blog posts or answering questions on our web dev or whatever, like be a familiar person and then let people find your podcast. I think that's a very important thing in life, or even maybe our web dev is too big. Maybe you need to just be in r/view or r/react or something.
Perhaps, yeah, niche it out a little bit more.
Don't do it bad. Don't do a bad guy. Don't be a sleazeball like self-promoter, but like be there, be helpful. And then, you know, I think you have to kind of be a known entity. Not saying you're not, but like.
It works both ways too. Can't you imagine a blogger being like, oh, nobody's reading my blog posts? It's probably because I don't have a podcast yet, you know? You're like, well, yeah, but it's both. What if you had both, you know?
Well, if you had both, do the both. And like, yeah, it's like, I think we said in our earlier show or whatever, is like, I wish I had a $7 thing or $9 thing somebody could buy, you know, like, wouldn't that be cool? You know, like if I had the blog and the podcast and the thing to sell, like that's, you know, and then, but like, if I just was like, no, you know, cold called, like changed my name and everything. And just like, was like, here's a, buy my course, you know, it's like, no one's going to buy it or whatever, you know, like you gotta like reach out and talk to people and share opinions and share what you learned and stuff. It's old web stuff, I think. So that's what I'd say. And that's I think general advice, not specifically, I think for Thunder Nerds, cause it is a good podcast. So you could also write into another podcast and ask them about your show. So that's another trick to build your audience.
There's a lot of tricks we haven't figured out. So just know that not all of that was directed at Thunder Nerds necessarily. It's just kind of general riffing. And
growth is hard. Growth is hard. So, I mean, I think like we more or less had the same numbers for a long time, you know, and not to say just because people go in and out, you know.
Yeah, we're like, still pretty flat, really. It's not like we're in a super growth phase, really. And a lot, you know, you see podcasts that just kick off and they just blow right past us because they just do something a lot better than we ever did, you know?
talked a lot about Netlify Build before, the Git workflow for web development, where you can build, deploy, and manage modern web projects super easily with Netlify. They just launched something new they're calling Netlify Dev, where you can run their entire platform right on your laptop, or your desktop, I suppose, too. You can preview it all, site generation, functions, and edge logic. So imagine the productivity boost of being able to locally test your site generator, API integrations, serverless functions, and edge rules all in a single development server. That's Netlify Dev, a powerful way to build and test modern web apps on your local machine. With one simple command, you can install Netlify Dev to use on any project. That'll spawn a fully local environment of Netlify Dev that automatically detects and runs your site generator, makes environment variables available, performs edge logic and routing rules, and compiles and runs cloud functions. The extra bonus is that you can even stream that live, so Netlify Dev takes hot reloading to a whole new level, allowing you to actually stream your dev server to a live URL, which is great for collaborative development. You can now share your work as you work and get instant feedback. So I could be working on my site, I could have it open in a browser, open on my phone, see the changes live as they're happening, but you could also have it wherever you are in the world, open on your browser or on your phone, and whenever I update something, the site will update and you'd be able to see it. Netlify Dev automatically detects common tools like Gatsby, Hugo, Jekyll, React Static, 11D, and more, providing a zero config setup for your local dev server. Netlify has faithfully replicated their powerful Edge Logic engine in WebAssembly so you can locally test all the same rules before deploying them to their global infrastructure. You can write cloud functions in modern JavaScript, adding needed dependencies. Netlify will compile your functions as AWS Lambdas and deploy them as full API endpoints. Local testing works too. It all comes with Netlify Live, a hosted service that continually runs your dev command, just like you do locally, watching for changes. The result is an instant preview you can share with your entire team with live updates as code and content changes. Like I said at the beginning, Netlify Dev installs with the Netlify CLI, create new sites, set up continuous deployment, and push new deploys right from the command line. And Netlify Dev is just the beginning. Take your local development to Netlify Build, power collaboration through Netlify's Git-based workflow with deploy previews, branch testing, and more. So check out Netlify Dev at netlify.com. And our thanks to Netlify for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Next question, audio question, our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show. Zach Handing writes in.
Hey guys, my day-to-day involves writing all the semantic HTML, CSS, and JavaScript for our client projects, and then I hand my code to one of our backend developers to integrate into whichever CMS we're using, typically Sitecore or AEM. My question is, what have you found is the best way to keep the front-end developer and back-end developer roles separate while avoiding maintaining two completely separate code repos? Thanks.
So I didn't expect that to be where this was going. So you're trying to work less together.
We don't like each other. Or maybe it's like they want to keep working on the front end, without all the legacy back end stuff. Like how do you do anything like that?
I can trying to wrap my head around it at all. So, Zach does HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, and then does that first for whatever reason, and then says, here you go, backend developers, make this thing work in this CMS. And so, he wants to keep doing that, it sounds like, and doesn't want to, you got to start somewhere, and you can't just keep all your code on your computer, so what do you do with it? Do you have a repo that's called, my project and then -FED or something, because it's just the front end part, and then or what, I don't know. This is
Brad Frost had a post recently, front end design, React, and a bridge over the Great Divide, kind of talking about Chris's Great Divide, or kind of what we learned here on the Shop Talk Show. And it's you kind of, he's advocating for things like React or Vue or Angular or whatever you have, kind of being the bridge between the design tool and the markup, the pristine markup, and then the backend integration. And the idea here is somebody can take your React front-end code and make some minor modifications and make it backend ready, if that makes sense. They can just plug it into the backend. where maybe you're using dummy data and the designer experience, you can just plug it into the back end. And this makes a lot of sense to me. This is sort of where we're going in our code and design systems and things like that. But would it be great if you could just do HTML with HTML imports? Yes, it would, but you can't. So you're kind of looking at the JavaScript kind of to leverage that into everything. So that might be a solution for you.
Kind of tricky. Delivering a design system might be, you know, that's just kind of the root of it, right? If you build that, it'll be useful wherever.
Yeah. And I was going to say, Tyler Sticka on the Cloud for blog, and I'm live Googling here. He had an article about like Cloud for is doing design systems and PWAs and things like that. And he had a really good post, and I think I like really like it, but it's tips for portable patterns. I'll drop a link in the show notes. But he's kind of like organizes his code base like a React or an Angular or Vue project where like you make components and those are in like components folders, you know, and then you inside like my whatever component buttons, you have a button.css, button.js, and a button.handlebar, you know, like he just has the template, the JavaScript, and the CSS needed to render that component. And I find that to be a pretty good way to do it. And that way everything's pretty self-contained. You're separating concerns, but you're also bundling up components. You're kind of doing component driven design. Take a look at this. Maybe for me, it was like this is kind of what I've been trying to do. And it was very much like this is kind of how we're doing it. And then, you know, if they implement it in React or AEM or whatever, they can do whatever. They can modify the patterns, but you know, if they see a change to whatever pattern.css and not a change to pattern.handlebars, then they know, oh, this is just a CSS change, not a markup change. So I can just drop that file in, you know. So maybe that helps. So
Christian Knoll says here, how come when you're installing dependencies in a project, like, you know, npm install, the command line might spit out a thing that says like 38 warnings and 3 errors in the terminal, even at high profile project repos? Doesn't anybody have a stable group of dependencies? Should I be nervous about this?
Oh, this is a good question.
So it's npm warning you. So they do their own audit, right?
So yeah, npm audit is a thing. Like it's like security warnings, like very like these are known vulnerabilities in these like packages, like they use SNCC or something like that to like find out like a package vulnerability database of some kind. Man, I had 16,000 the other day, and I think it was from Jest, like Jest the testing framework, right? You know, I'm sure they've patched it since then. But man, 16,000 like vulnerabilities, that was pretty serious. But I have seen like when you install and it's like error, couldn't install whatever, some plugin skipping, you know, and have you ever seen that, like where it just like tries to install something and then it just says, fails. Oh, I'm just skipping. It says skipping, but then like the project still works and compiles. So it's like this weird like optional dependency or something. I've never really understood that.
I don't understand why, that necessarily either. And also that like a lot of times when so just for the core of it here, I feel like if you run that audit fix command, in my experience, it just fixes it all of it. And then you just, it changes some version numbers in your package JSON and lock, and you just commit it and you're back to normal. And the only reason you're seeing them is because whoever has that repo just hasn't done that in the last week or so. Maybe sometimes they're more serious than that, but usually not. I mean, I feel like I've seen this a million times. I run the command, it upgrades some dependencies, ship it, you know?
Yeah, this is so weird. I didn't know you could do optional dependencies, but yeah, there's a flag, no optional, to like skip optional dependencies.
Is it like if it uses...
Because I see it on Windows, because it tries to install like FS events, file system events.
Oh, which is not a thing.
Which is a Mac-only thing.
Yeah.
And so like, so it's... So some things try to use that and they are built off of that, but it's so weird. Anyway,
Fascinating.
But I didn't know, I don't know how you like specify an optional dependency. You know what I mean? Because I have dev and anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. There's, yeah, because there's a bunch of different types, right? This, we went through all this while we're still, after all this time, developing some NPM features at CodePen. And it's just a, you know, it's a hornet's nest of difficulty, of course, but we'll get there. But anyway, there's like, there's dev dependencies and dependencies, right? Like those are pretty clear. And, you know, the idea is...
I understand that.
Yeah, that one's clear. But then there's another kind, right, that are... But they're not optional, though. They're just like a middle kind. I forget what that one's called.
Test? Or is it...
No.
Or test goes into the dev, I think.
And the truth is that people get them wrong all the time. And it kind of like doesn't matter, you know? Even like pretty big repos just have the wrong stuff in the wrong section. And
I will tell you, man, I will never forget the day I wanted to get a NPM package counter package. So NPM installed package counter or something like that. And it installs a whole bunch of stuff. And at some point it starts recompiling SAS for like a command line utility that just counts the number of packages in a folder. And like, I just was like, oh man, I'm out of here. Like I just wanted you to like parse my package lock or something, or like just give me a rough number, but it started like recompiling SAS. And so I quit out of it, but it's just all to say like somebody had some dependency in there that triggered another dependency that didn't need to be there. So dependencies are rough.
So it's peer. That's the one I was thinking of, which is just like
peer dependency.
Yeah. It's like tangential. What's an example of a Dave jQuery plugin, like FitVids or something?
FitVids.
You might put jQuery as a peer dependency because it's like, it needs jQuery, but it's not, it's like, it's a peer, you know? I don't know if that's a good...
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't need jQuery to run, to execute, but it kind of does, I guess. So maybe it is it's a tricky one. But I think of it as like, it's just something else that you probably need to go with it, but it's not necessarily a dependency.
Hmm. Yeah, that's wild.
That is definitely misused. So good luck with that.
Oh, I can't even. Yeah, I guess live here on the podcast, I can't even. I'm trying to like be like, when would I use that exactly? And that's tough. Anyway, well, is that our last question?
Let me read one more. I'll just pick one off of our Trello integration here. Why not? Evan Minto writes in, I can't remember if you've talked about this, but what's up with customized built-in elements? Chrome 67 recently enabled them and Firefox is working on an implementation, but Safari seems fundamentally permanently opposed to them. Do you know what he's talking about? What's a customized built-in element? Like a web component?
Like like the is equals syntax on custom elements.
Oh,
like,
right.
Like button is my button, and you add a bunch of behaviors and bind a bunch of stuff.
So you get all the benefits of button, and you can write your own JavaScript and stuff to it?
Yeah, instead of like your top level, it's basically like the top level wrapper of this is going to be a button, like, and then I want you to modify,
create
a shadow DOM inside of the button and do everything. You know,
I could see
how everything inside
feels scary, but also cool because, like, that means it's stopping people from implementing their own buttons. Like, oh,
yeah. And if you think about like audio or something like that, like, audio is podcast player or something, and that has like the, you know, 1x, 2x, 3x buttons or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can think of like that, like these would be like ways to extend native elements and even like use the shadow DOM to give your own UI and like kind of. Or select is custom select, you know, like I'm going to take a select mint box and make it my own thing. So these are kind of common use cases for that. But Safari's kind of, I think, said like, no, we're not going to let you customize native elements. And
that's funny, isn't it? Because isn't sorry. It like if two browsers like it and not only like it, but agree on it and ship it, that's enough for a web standard, right? Like then it can move along the spec process and be finalized. At that point, does Safari just say, oh, well, I guess we lost this one. We have to implement it. Or are they, I mean, there's no laws around this stuff. You know, they can fucking do whatever they want, right? But is it, it would be kind of in bad taste to just never do it once it's a standard, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, it's really, I mean, at least for like the Western mobile web or whatever, like that really like throttles what we can do, you know, like that they just say no. And then it's like, well, we don't get it until next year. Maybe we'll get it next year. They don't tell us what we're getting, but maybe we'll get it next year. So,
you remember we've talked about on the show, which I haven't been able to get out of my mind really, is all the awesome stuff Chrome does. They're in a sense, like, I think you called it like DDoSing Firefox on features because they just can't keep up. So, and then it's not, you know, sometimes they're just kind of dropped in Chrome, although, you know, this is a very nuanced thing or whatever, but I just saw one the other day or today, maybe it was like, where did I see? It was like a native content or a contact picker for the web. So, you know, like the web payments API is like native in browser payments stuff. So you could like save credit cards in your browser and then the browser can ask for that data and it's securely transferred over, which is really, really cool because it just like reduces a lot of checkout payment problems. You know, like every browser in the world has saved passwords, right? Why doesn't it save your credit cards too? Then you're about to check out and you just go whoop and just send it all through. Now, it doesn't just drop your credit card data into a form because that's who knows what's happening there. That's scary. It's an API that handles all the scariness. How cool. So this looks like in vain of that, a contact picker. Why can't the browser have an API that attaches to your native contact picker and has all the security stuff built in, and I can pick Dave Rupert from a list and maybe his address autofills or who knows what it does with that data. Looks pretty cool, you know? But it's just like, where did this come from? Was it a spec first, or is this just like the hordes of people working on Chrome just be like, hey, this would be cool, let's do it. Here you go.
You know, there's been a lot of talk kind of lately, but some of these are because, like, these features are made because somebody needs it, you know, like a company with a big enough name needs it. Like, why do we have CSS Grid? Because Microsoft needed it for Windows 8, you know, like Microsoft needed MS Grid for Windows 8 and MSN.com. And then I think Bloomberg or something was like, we'll implement that or whatever in Chrome or something like that because they wanted it. And so, like, a lot of these features exist because somebody wants them. Like, why do we have?
And that's good, right? Like, that it's like, I don't know. I'm sure there's nuance to it, but I feel like I've heard that said in the past. Is like, that's where we want ideas to come from. Needs, real needs.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you know, WebKit has this wet floor. Have you seen WebKit Text Reflect or whatever?
Yeah,
like or Box Reflect, where you can like create this like, oh, it's like a shimmery wet floor, you know, and that's all from like Apple marketing in the early 2000s.
But it's behind not a flag at the time. It was a what do you call it? A vendor dash WebKit, a vendor prefix. Yeah.
But it's in some other browsers too, or, you know, and so like we have this now.
That was the problem with vendor prefixes. People start using them, and then of all of a sudden you got Firefox being like, well, I guess we have to implement your freaking WebKit prefix because enough people used it. We had to for compat. Wow.
Anyway, I think it's like pretty like just it's for me. It is good. It like these are meeting actual needs. But for me, it's just like also this like. It's also like not, I don't know. It's just like one company wants it. So they like put it in the browser, you know? So like, and so how do we get, you know, how do we get Apple to be like, I actually want web components to work, you know, like how, cause they even, I think they said that to the custom elements V2 or whatever, which is what I think the, that is syntaxes. I think Apple's basically said no to it. And so like now it's dead. Like what is all web components now dead? Cause Apple's like shutting down the, you know,
maybe
it's not dead. I hate to be dead. Dead's a strong word, but it's severely hindered would be my like, you know, like,
yeah.
So now we have to like undo or, I guess refigure out what we're doing here. So yeah.
It's dangerous territory because if there is perfect implementations in both all of Chromium-based stuff and Firefox, then developers starts being like, I'm just going to use this. I don't care, which is dangerous territory. you know? And it's also dangerous territory for browsers to just be like, no, I'm putting my foot down so hard on this thing that I just will never do it. And then, you know, it's like, it's dangerous. It's tiptoes into browser wars stuff. You know, if browsers totally stop being friendly with each other, then God save us all, you know?
There has been some talk, like, you know, I think I've heard it in a couple contexts, but I think I mentioned it before, like, but Mike Taylor from Mozilla, he spoke about something Mozilla had to implement because IE, like 5, implemented something, and then KHTML Conqueror, which then Safari was built off, also implemented it, and so Chrome has it, and then it ends up just IE made this weird thing called window.event, right? It's weird, but it's basically like the current event that's happening in the window right now, like a click, you know? And so window.event will say this click event, you know? So weird, but people started building off of it, off of a non-spec for IE. And then it got into Safari and everything. It doesn't work in Firefox. They have tons of issues. And so they go out to fix it, and they fix it, and they ship it. And then it like takes down Confluence, just like takes it out, just like wrecks Jira or whatever. And they're like, what the heck? So now they have to have like a if statement in Firefox. So like, if Confluence, then don't do this. Like,
in the
don't
browser, they built that in?
In the browser, what? Yeah. Because like shipping this feature, this non-standard web platform feature, or that's now kind of a
standard.
Can't
they just put window.event back or whatever? They didn't want to do that, I guess.
Well, there was a bunch of logic from like, usually it's like a WYSIWYG editor or whatever that people are using. And they'll go check on it and see how many times they hit this threshold or whatever. But like, yeah, like basically they fixing the platform bug broke websites because they relied on these if Firefox do something else or something. So anyway, it's dumb, but it's the way, you know, it's messy. And so but Mike Taylor was kind of like just pitching. He's saying like, no one at Mozilla is actually thinking this, but like, what if we all reset and fork off of Chrome? What is life like? What did we win? What did we lose? And maybe that's a good place to end the podcast, but I've been thinking about
just cut to black.
Just cut to black. Fade out to black. But like, I've been thinking about it because it's like, what do we lose? And I mean, there are people who are like, I hate it, you know, and I totally get that. But you know, it is sort of like, what if we just reset? What if we, like, this is the new 1991 where we all like fork off a Netscape or something like that, you know, like maybe this is the new 1993. And so we reset and then we kind of,
people just compete on browser features. I'm always so attracted when a browser drops a feature that's not a web standards thing. It doesn't affect how websites render, but it's just a super cool browser feature. It's like a UI thing, a helpfulness thing. It changes how it remembers your history or helps you do something on the web that, you know, and you're like, awesome, that's totally what you should be competing on. Love it, you know?
Edge for me is that, like, I like Edge, like, mountains more than Chrome. And no, all respect to people who work on Chrome who are listening to this, no doubt. But they, but like, the Edge stuff, I like how it looks more. It's better looking to me. The DevTools theme is better to me. Like, everything, there's like half a dozen things that are, I'm just like, that is better than what Chrome looks like. And so I'm going to use Edge. So there's stuff like that. So that's cool. You know, Brave is another Chromium thing. It's like, they're like, oh, you get a crypto wallet, you know, and you can like visit websites and donate to them.
I just signed up for that
really
thing.
Dumb.
I still got to figure out.
You did?
Yeah. The basic attention tokens or something.
I want to hear how many Bitcoins you have by the end of this. Because I don't see that being a feature that people will use, but it's just interesting.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about if that one's going to win, but Bruce Lawson's got me trying. God, I'm about to go off on a tangent, but check out coil.com, like a spring, but a coil. And so it's whatever. It's just yet another one of these micro payments from the people that look at your thing, and you sign up and you pay them $5 a month, and then it distributes your $5 to the websites you visit that are monetized in this way, which will be like 0.001% of the websites, you know. But I put it on CSS Tricks, but Bruce had me convinced because they're pushing for it to be a web standard, literally a web standard meta tag. That you put on there, and you put like a wallet ID on it. That's also a standard that these like online banks can implement. And then it won't just be a COIL thing. It'll just be like anybody who wants to build a monetization system is built off of this web standard. And it works like, you know, there's a document object in the DOM. There'll be a thing off the end of it called document.monetization. And so you test for it in your code. You say, is document dot monetization exist? And it will if the meta tag is there and it's doing its thing. Right now, this happens through a browser extension that you have to install, but it works in the way that they think the web standard should work. So I've got it installed and I have a paid account as well. And so then you wait for an event because it doesn't happen right away. It has to do some crap to like talk to the bank and, you know, prove that you have funds and all that stuff. And it takes about 2 seconds, which I find way too long, but, you know, such as it is right now, you'll get an event, and then document.monetization.started will have a value of, you know, monetizing or not monetizing or whatever. There's some standard values. And so you can tell totally anonymously whether somebody's paying you or not on the site. So there's no, I can't tell who you are. I just know that you're giving me some money, some micropayments. So for example, it's trivial for me to write a feature that just doesn't show you ads because, you know, or I could put a link to a secure download link to my ebook because you're monetizing. Okay,
yeah, because if you're like, you have window.monetize, you can just, you could say if window.monetize do nothing, or like the monetize one or whatever, else put ads. You know, like, that's cool.
Oh, and you have all kinds of information about it, too, that happens as part of this document process. Yeah, it's cool. And they're not, you know, they're hoping that they're just, you know, the company that started it, but they're hoping to make it a web standard and then just compete against everybody else. So I was like, fine, I'll sign up for it. You know, I've made a few bucks so far. It's fine. I just mostly just think it's interesting. It's not replacing anything. But if it becomes a web standard, that's a big deal. And look, I'm signed into my little account right now. I've made $7. $7 to me isn't that much money, but it's not that bad. But, you know, there's parts of the world where $7 goes a lot further than in the United States.
Oh, man, I only make $20 on my ads. I mean, so like, I mean, but like, I don't know what the volume that equals in like per view for you, but like, that's good money.
I think it's cool.
Compared to $0 with somebody running an ad blogger. You know what I mean?
So Google's got a thing too called, you know, Google Publishers or something. It's the same kind of concept. And there's this Braves little attention token thing, right? I'm going to put them all on my site if I can. I think you got to be invited to the Google one, but why not? Why not play this little game for a while and see who wins and see if they can all agree on a web standard. And I think that's good for the web.
Yeah. No, I like this. I might sign up and become a member. Why not? Because this is what you want to support, right? $5 a month, $60 a year. I'm supporting the internet and publishers. And
yeah, at the moment, it's cool. Kind of COIL focused. So you got to play that game a little bit. But it's nice. It's nice software as far as I can tell. You know, it helps that a guy like Bruce Lawson's the guy telling me about it. You know, I have some trust for him that goes a long way here. Like, if I just got an email about this from any old random person, I probably would have been like, I don't know.
From Turd Buckman. If Turd Buckman.
I might Silicon look Valley at it and be like, this looks nice, but you know. But you have a friend and a longtime web standards advocate like Bruce telling you, then you do it. You
know? No, that does. That, and this actually seems, I don't know, more interesting to me than, you know, the Bitcoin thing in Brave, but those could also be the same thing in 2 years when this gets standardized or whatever.
Yeah, if one of these wins, you better believe the rest of them are going to just hop on the web standard, I would think.
And this would be great. I think this is good because you're, yeah, I don't know. I like it. I would love it. I don't know. We definitely need a new monetization system on the web, and hopefully this gets us there. So who knows?
All right.
Well, speaking of money, be sure to hit that subscribe button and that like button on your podcast of choice. That really helps us out. Head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And I forgot to mention our Twitter. So @shoptalkshow, tens of tweets a month. Crits, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
JobDocJoe.com.